prospect of paying out $9 a month forever, they found just as hard to face. All day and all night, for nearly a whole week, they wrestled with the problem. And then in the end, Jorgis took the responsibility. Brother Jonas had gotten his job and was pushing a truck in Durham's, and the killing gang at Brown's continued to work early and late so that Jorgis grew more confident every hour, more certain of his mastership. It was the kind of thing the man of the family had to decide and carry through, he told himself. Others might have failed at it, but he was not the failing kind. He would show them how to do it. He would work all day and all night, too, if need be. He would never rest until the house was paid for and his people had a home. So he told them, and so in the end, the decision was made. They had talked about looking at more houses before they made the purchase, but then they did not know where any more were, and they did not know any way of finding out. The one they had seen held the sway in their thoughts. Whenever they thought of themselves in a house, it was this house that they thought of. And so they went and told the agent that they were ready to make the agreement. They knew, as an abstract proposition, that in matters of business all men are to be accounted liars. But they could not but have been influenced by all they had heard from the eloquent agent and were quite persuaded that the house was something they had run a risk of losing by their delay. They drew a deep breath when he told them that they were still in time. They were to come on the morrow, and he would have the papers all drawn up. This matter of papers was one in which Jorgis understood to the full need of caution. Yet he could not go himself. Everyone told him that he could not get a holiday, and that he might lose his job by asking. So there was nothing to be done but to trust it to the women, with Shedvilas, who promised to go with him. Jorgis spent a whole evening impressing upon them the seriousness of the occasion, and then finally, out of innumerable hiding places about their persons and in their baggage, came forth the precious wads of money, to be done up tightly in a little bag and sewed fast in the lining of Teta Elzbieta's dress. Early in the morning they sallied forth. Jorgis had given them so many instructions, and warned them against so many perils, that the women were quite pale with fright. And even the imperturbable delicatessen vendor, who prided himself upon being a businessman, was ill at ease. The agent had the deed all ready, and invited them to sit down and read it. This Shedvilas proceeded to do, a painful and laborious process during which the agent drummed upon the desk. Teta Elzbieta was so embarrassed that the perspiration came out upon her forehead in beads. For was not this reading as much as to say plainly to the gentleman's face that they doubted his honesty? Yet Jokubas Shedvilas read on and on, and presently there developed that he had good reason for doing so, for a horrible suspicion had begun dawning in his mind. He knitted his brows more and more as he read. This was not a deed of sale at all, so far as he could see. It provided only for the renting of the property. It was hard to tell, with all this strange legal jargon, words he had never heard before, but was not this plain? The party of the first part hereby covenants and agrees to rent to the said party of the second part. And then again, a monthly rental of $12 for a period of 8 years and 4 months. Then Shedvilas took off his spectacles and looked at the agent and stammered a question. The agent was most polite and explained that that was the usual formula, that it was always arranged that the property should be merely rented. He kept trying to show them something in the next paragraph, but Shedvilas could not get by the word rental, and when he translated it to Teta Elzbieta, she was thrown into a fright. They would not own the home at all, then, for nearly 9 years. The agent, with infinite patience, began to explain again, but no explanation would do now. Elzbieta had firmly fixed in her mind the last solemn warning of Jorgis. If there is anything wrong, do not give him the money, but go out and get a lawyer. It was an agonizing moment, but she sat in the chair, her hands clenched like death, and made a fearful effort, summoning all her powers, and gasped out her purpose. Jokubas translated her words. She expected the agent to fly into a passion, but he was, to her bewilderment, as ever, imperturbable. He even offered to go and get a lawyer for her, but she declined this. They went a long way on purpose to find a man who would not be a confederate. Then, let anyone imagine their dismay when, after half an hour, they came in with a lawyer and heard him greet the agent by his first name. They felt that all was lost. They sat like prisoners summoned to hear the reading of their death warrant. There was nothing more that they could do. They were trapped. The lawyer read over the deed, and when he had read it, he informed Shadvelis that it was all perfectly regular, that the deed was a blank deed, such as was often used in these sales. "And was the price as agreed?" the old man asked. $300 down, and the balance at $12 a month, till a total of $1,500 had been paid. Yes, that was correct. And it was for the sale of such and such a house, the house and lot and everything? Yes, and the lawyer showed him where that was all written. And it was all perfectly regular. There were no tricks about it of any sort. They were poor people, and this was all they had in the world. And if there was anything wrong, they would be ruined. And so Shadvelis went on, asking one trembling question after another, while the eyes of the women folks were fixed upon him in mute agony. They could not understand what he was saying, but they knew that upon it their fate depended. And when at last he had questioned, until there was no more questioning to be done, and the time came for them to make up their minds and either close the bargain or reject it, it was all that poor Teta Elzbieta could do to keep from bursting into tears. Jokubas had asked her if she wished to sign. He had asked her twice, and what could she say? How did she know if this lawyer were telling the truth, that he was not in the conspiracy? And yet, how could she say so? What excuse could she give? The eyes of everyone in the room were upon her, awaiting her decision. And at last, half blind with her tears, she began fumbling in her jacket, where she had pinned the precious money. And she brought it out and unwrapped it before the men. All of this Ona sat watching, from a corner of the room, twisting her hands together, meantime in a fever of fright. Ona longed to cry out and tell her stepmother to stop, that it was all a trap, but there seemed to be something clutching her by the throat, and she could not make a sound. And so Teta Elzbieta laid the money on the table. And the agent picked it up and counted it, and then wrote them a receipt for it, and passed them the deed. Then he gave a sigh of satisfaction, and rose and shook hands with them all, still as smooth and polite as at the beginning. Ona had a dim recollection of the lawyer telling Shadvelis that his charge was a dollar, which occasioned some debate and more agony, and then, after they had paid that too, they went out into the street, her stepmother clutching the deed in her hand. They were so weak from fright that they could not walk, but had to sit down on the way. So they went home with a deadly terror gnawing at their souls, and that evening Jorgis came home and heard their story, and that was the end. Jorgis was sure that they had been swindled and were ruined, and he tore his hair and cursed like a madman, swearing that he would kill the agent that very night. In the end, he seized the paper and rushed out of the house, and all the way across the yards to Halsted Street. He dragged Shadvelis out from his supper, and together they rushed to consult another lawyer. When they entered his office, the lawyer sprang up, for Jorgis looked like a crazy person, with flying hair and bloodshot eyes. His companion explained the situation, and the lawyer took the paper and began to read it, while Jorgis stood clutching the desk with knotted hands, trembling in every nerve. Once or twice the lawyer looked up and asked a question of Shadvelis. The other did not know a word that he was saying, but his eyes were fixed upon the lawyer's face, striving in an agony of dread to read his mind. He saw the lawyer look up and laugh, and he gave a gasp. The man said something to Shadvelis, and Jorgis turned upon his friend, his heart almost stopping. "Well?" he panted.
"He says it is all right," said Shadvelis.
"All right?"
"Yes, he says it is just as it should be."
And Jorgis, in his relief, sank down into a chair.
"Are you sure of it?" he gasped, and made Shadvelis translate question after question.
He could not hear it often enough. He could not ask with enough variations. Yes, they had bought the house. They had really bought it. It belonged to them. They had only to pay the money, and it would be all right. Then Jorgis covered his face with his hands, for there were tears in his eyes, and he felt like a fool. But he had had such a horrible fright. Strong man as he was, it left him almost too weak to stand up. The lawyer explained that the rental was a form. The property was said to be merely rented until the last payment had been made, the purpose being to make it easier to turn the party out if he did not make the payments. So long as they paid, however, they had nothing to fear. The house was all theirs.
Jorgis was so grateful that he paid the half dollar the lawyer asked without winking an eyelash, and then rushed home to tell the news to the family. He found Ona in a faint, and the baby screaming, and the whole house in an uproar, for it had been believed by all that he had gone to murder the agent. It was hours before the excitement could be calmed, and all through that cruel night Jorgis would wake up now and then and hear Ona and her stepmother in the next room, sobbing softly to themselves. Chapter 5. They had bought their home. It was hard for them to realize that the wonderful house was theirs to move into whenever they chose. They spent all their time thinking about it and what they were going to put into it. As their week with Anyele was up in 3 days, they lost no time in getting ready. They had to make some shift to furnish it, and every instant of their leisure was given to discussing this. A person who had such a task before him would not need to look very far in Packingtown. He had only to walk up the avenue and read the signs, or get into a streetcar to obtain full information as to pretty much everything a human creature could need. It was quite touching, the zeal of people, to see that his health and happiness were provided for. Did the person wish to smoke? There was a little discourse about cigars, showing him exactly why the Thomas Jefferson 5-cent Perfecto was the only cigar worthy of the name. Had he, on the other hand, smoked too much? There was a remedy for the smoking habit, 25 doses for a quarter, and a cure absolutely guaranteed in 10 doses. In innumerable ways such as this, the traveler found that somebody had been busied to make smooth his paths through the world, and to let him know what had been done for him. In Packingtown, the advertisements had a style all of their own, adapted to the peculiar population. One would be tenderly solicitous. "Is your wife pale?" it would inquire. "Is she discouraged? Does she drag herself about the house and find fault with everything? Why do you not tell her to try Dr. Lanahan's life preservers?" Another would be jocular in tone, slapping you on the back, so to speak. "Don't be a chump," it would exclaim. "Go and get the Goliath bunion cure." "Get a move on you," would chime in another. "It's easy if you wear the Eureka 250 shoe." Among these importunate signs was one that had caught the attention of the family by its pictures. It showed two very little birds building themselves a home, and Maria had asked an acquaintance to read it to her, and told them that it related to the furnishing of a house. "Feather your nest," it ran, and went on to say that it could furnish all the necessary feathers for a 4-room nest for the ludicrously small sum of $75. The particularly important thing about this offer was that only a small part of the money need be had at once. The rest, one might pay a few dollars every month. Our friends had to have some furniture. There was no getting away from that. But their little fund of money had sunk so low that they could hardly get to sleep at night, and so they fled to this as their deliverance. There was more agony in another paper for Elsbieta to sign, and then one night, when Jorgis came home, he was told the breathless tidings that the furniture had arrived and was safely stowed in the house. A parlor set of 4 pieces, a bedroom set of 3 pieces, a dining room table and 4 chairs, a toilet set with beautiful pink roses painted all over it, an assortment of crockery also with pink roses, and so on. One of the plates in the set had been found broken when they unpacked it, and Ona was going to the store the first thing in the morning to make them change it. Also, they had promised 3 saucepans, and there had only 2 come. And did Jorgis think that they were trying to cheat them? The next day they went to the house, and when the men came from work, they ate a few hurried mouthfuls at Anyele's, and then set to work at the task of carrying their belongings to their new home. The distance was in reality over 2 miles, but Jorgis made 2 trips that night, each time with a huge pile of mattresses and bedding on his head, with bundles of clothing and bags and things tied up inside. Anywhere else in Chicago, he would have stood a good chance of being arrested, but the policemen in Packingtown were apparently used to these informal movings and contented themselves with a cursory examination now and then. It was quite wonderful to see how fine the house looked with all the things in it, even by the dim light of a lamp. It was really home, and almost as exciting as the placard had described it. Ona was fairly dancing, and she and Cousin Maria took Jorgis by the arm and escorted him from room to room, sitting in each chair by turns, and then insisting that he should do the same. One chair squeaked with his great weight, and they screamed with fright and woke the baby and brought everybody running. Altogether, it was a great day. And tired as they were, Jorgis and Ona sat up late, contented simply to hold each other and gaze in rapture about the room. They were going to be married as soon as they could get everything settled and a little spare money put by. And this was to be their home. That little room, yonder, would be theirs. It was, in truth, a never-ending delight, the fixing up of this house. They had no money to spend for the pleasure of spending, but there were a few absolutely necessary things, and the buying of these was a perpetual adventure for Ona. It must always be done at night, so that Jorgis could go along, and even if it were only a pepper cruet, or a half a dozen glasses for 10 cents, that was enough for an expedition. On Saturday night, they came home with a great basket full of things and spread them out on the table while everyone stood round and the children climbed up on the chairs or howled to be lifted up to see. There were sugar and salt and tea and crackers and a can of lard and a milk pail and a scrubbing brush and a pair of shoes for the second oldest boy and a can of oil and a tack hammer and a pound of nails. These last were to be driven into the walls of the kitchen and the bedrooms to hang things on, and there was a family discussion as to the place where each one was to be driven. Then Jorgis would try to hammer and hit his fingers because the hammer was too small, and get mad because Ona had refused to let him pay 15 cents more and get a bigger hammer. And Ona would be invited to try it herself and hurt her thumb and cry out, which necessitated the thumbs being kissed by Jorgis. Finally, after everyone had had a try, the nails would be driven and something hung up. Jorgis had come home with a big packing box on his head, and he sent Jonas to get another that he had bought. He meant to take one side out of these tomorrow and put shelves in them and make them into bureaus and places to keep things for the bedrooms. The nest which had been advertised had not included feathers for quite so many birds as there were in this family. They had, of course, put their dining table in the kitchen, and the dining room was used as the bedroom of Teta Elzbieta and 5 of her children. She and the 2 youngest slept in the only bed, and the other 3 had a mattress on the floor. Ona and her cousin dragged a mattress into the parlor and slept at night, and the 3 men and the oldest boy slept in the other room, having nothing but the very level floor to rest on for the present. Even so, however, they slept soundly. It was necessary for Teta Elzbieta to pound more than once on the door at 5:15 every morning. She would have ready a great pot full of steaming black coffee, and oatmeal, and bread, and smoked sausages. And then she would fix them their dinner pails, with more thick slices of bread with lard between them. They could not afford butter. And some onions, and a piece of cheese, and so they would tramp away to work. This was the first time in his life that he had ever really worked, it seemed to Jorgis. It was the first time that he had ever had anything to do which took all he had in him. Jorgis had stood with the rest up in the gallery and watched the men on the killing beds, marveling at their speed and power, as if they had been wonderful machines. It somehow never occurred to one to think of the flesh and blood side of it. That is, not until he actually got down into the pit and took off his coat. Then he saw things in a different light. He got at the inside of them. The pace they set here, it was one that called for every faculty of a man. From the instant the first steer fell, till the sounding of the noon whistle, and again from 12:30 till heaven only knew what hour in the late afternoon or evening, there was never one instant's rest for a man. For his hand, or his eye, or his brain. Jorgis saw how they managed it. There were portions of the work which determined the pace of the rest, and for these they had picked men whom they paid high wages and whom they changed frequently. You might easily pick out these pacemakers, for they worked under the eye of the bosses, and they worked like men possessed. This was called speeding up the gang. And if any man could not keep up with the pace, there were hundreds outside begging to try. Yet Jorgis did not mind it. He rather enjoyed it. It saved him the necessity of flinging his arms about and fidgeting as he did in most work. He would laugh to himself as he ran down the line, darting a glance now and then at the man ahead of him. It was not the pleasantest work one could think of, but it was necessary work. And what more had a man the right to ask than a chance to do something useful and to get good pay for doing it? So Jorgis thought, and so he spoke, in his bold, free way. Very much to his surprise, he found that it had a tendency to get him into trouble. for most of the men here took a fearfully different view of the thing. He was quite dismayed when he first began to find it out that most of the men hated their work. It seemed strange. It was even terrible when you came to find out the universality of the sentiment. But it was certainly the fact they hated their work. They hated the bosses, and they hated the owners. They hated the whole place, the whole neighborhood, even the whole city, with an all-inclusive hatred, bitter and fierce. Women and little children would fall to cursing about it. It was rotten, rotten as hell. Everything was rotten. When Jorgis would ask them what they meant, they would begin to get suspicious and content themselves with saying, "Never mind, you stay here and see for yourself." One of the first problems that Jorgis ran upon was that of the unions. He had had no experience with unions, and he had to have it explained to him that the men were banded together for the purpose of fighting for their rights. Jorgis asked them what they meant by their rights, a question in which he was quite sincere, for he had not any idea of any rights that he had, except the right to hunt for a job and do as he was told when he got it. Generally, however, this harmless question would only make his fellow workmen lose their tempers and call him a fool. There was a delegate of the Butcher Helpers Union who came to see Jorgis to enroll him, and when Jorgis found that this meant that he would have to part with some of his money, he froze up directly, and the delegate, who was an Irishman and only knew a few words of Lithuanian, lost his temper and began to threaten him. In the end, Jorgis got into a fine rage and made it sufficiently plain that it would take more than one Irishman to scare him into a union. Little by little, he gathered that the main thing the men wanted was to put a stop to the habit of speeding up. They were trying their best to force a lessening of the pace, for there were some, they said, who could not keep up with it, whom it was killing. But Jorgis had no sympathy with such ideas as this. He could do the work himself, and so could the rest of them, he declared, if they were good for anything. If they couldn't do it, let them go somewhere else. Jorgis had not studied the books, and he would not have known how to pronounce laissez-faire, but he had been around the world enough to know that a man has to shift for himself in it, and that if he gets the worst of it, there is nobody to listen to him holler. Yet there have been known to be philosophers and plain men who swore by Malthus in the books and would nevertheless subscribe to a relief fund in time of a famine. It was the same with Jorgis, who consigned the unfit to destruction, while going about all day, sick at heart because of his poor old father, who was wandering somewhere in the yards, begging for a chance to earn his bread. Old Antanas had been a worker ever since he was a child. He had run away from home when he was 12 because his father beat him for trying to learn to read. And he was a faithful man, too. He was a man you might leave alone for a month if only you had made him understand what you wanted him to do in the meantime. And now here he was, worn out in soul and body, and with no more place in the world than a sick dog. He had his home, as it happened, and someone who would care for him if he never got a job. But his son could not help thinking, suppose this had not been the case, and Tanis Urutkus had been into every building in Packingtown by this time, and into nearly every room. He had stood mornings among the crowd of applicants till the very policeman had come to know his face and to tell him to go home and give it up. He had been likewise to all the stores and saloons for a mile about, begging for some little thing to do, and everywhere they had ordered him out, sometimes with curses, and not once even stopping to ask him a question. So after all, there was a crack in the fine structure of Jorgis's faith in things as they are. The crack was wide while Dede Antanas was hunting a job, and it was yet wider when he finally got it. For one evening, the old man came home in a great state of excitement with a tale that he had been approached by a man in one of the corridors of the pickle rooms of Durham's and asked what he would pay to get a job. He had not known what to make of this at first, but the man had gone on with matter-of-fact frankness to say that he could get him a job, provided that he were willing to pay one-third of his wages for it. Was he a boss? Antanas had asked, to which the man had replied that that was nobody's business, but that he could do what he said. Jorgis had made some friends by this time, and he sought one of them and asked what this meant. The friend, who was named Timotius Kusleika, was a sharp little man who folded hides on the killing beds, and he listened to what Jorgis had to say without seeming at all surprised. "They were common enough," he said, "such cases of petty graft." It was simply some boss who proposed to add a little to his income. After Jorgis had been there a while, he would know that the plants were simply honeycombed with rottenness of that sort. The bosses grafted off the men, and they grafted off each other. And someday the superintendent would find out what boss, and then he would graft off the boss. Warming to the subject, Timoshus went on to explain the situation. Here was Durham's, for instance, owned by a man who was trying to make as much money out of it as he could, and did not care in the least how he did it. And underneath him, ranged in ranks and grades like an army, were managers and superintendents and foremen, each one driving the man next below him and trying to squeeze out of him as much work as possible. And all the men of the same rank were pitted against each other. The accounts of each were kept separately, and every man lived in terror of losing his job, if another made a better record than he. So from top to bottom, the place was simply a seething cauldron of jealousies and hatreds. There was no loyalty or decency anywhere about it. There was no place in it where a man counted for anything against a dollar. And worse than there being no decency, there was not even any honesty. The reason for that, who could say? It must have been old Durham in the beginning. It was a heritage, which the self-made merchant had left to his son, along with his millions. Jorgis would find out these things for himself if he stayed there long enough. It was the men who had to do all the dirty jobs. And so there was no deceiving them, and they caught the spirit of the place and did like all the rest. Jorgis had come there and thought he was going to make himself useful and rise and become a skilled man. But he would soon find out his error, for nobody rose in Packingtown by doing good work. You could lay that down for a rule. If you met a man who was rising in Packingtown, you met a knave. That man who had been sent to Jorgis's father by the boss, he would rise. The man who told tales and spied upon his fellows would rise. But the man who minded his own business and did his work, why, they would speed him up till they had worn him out, and then they would throw him into the gutter. Jorgis went home with his head buzzing. Yet he could not bring himself to believe such things. No, it could not be so. Timoshus was simply another of the grumblers. He was a man who spent all his time fiddling, and he would go to parties at night and not get home till sunrise, and so of course he did not feel like work. Then, too, he was a puny little chap, and so he had been left behind in the race, and that was why he was sore. And yet so many strange things kept coming to Jorgis's notice every day. He tried to persuade his father to have nothing to do with the offer, but old Antanas had begged until he was worn out, and all his courage was gone. He wanted a job, any sort of a job, so the next day he went and found the man who had spoken to him, and promised to bring him a third of all he earned, and that same day he was put to work in Durham's cellars. It was a pickle room, where there was never a dry spot to stand upon, and so he had to take nearly the whole of his first week's earnings to buy him a pair of heavy-soled boots. He was a squeegee man. His job was to go about all day with a long-handled mop, swabbing up the floor. Except that it was damp and dark, it was not an unpleasant job in summer. Now Antanas Rudkus was the meekest man that God ever put on earth, and so Jorgis found it a striking confirmation of what the men all said, that his father had been at work only 2 days before he came home as bitter as any of them, and cursing Durham's with all the power of his soul. For they had set him to cleaning out the traps, and the family sat around and listened in wonder while he told them what that meant. It seemed that he was working in the room where the men prepared the beef for canning, and the beef had lain in vats full of chemicals, and men with great forks speared it out and dumped it into trucks to be taken to the cooking room. When they had speared out all they could reach, they emptied the vat on the floor, and then with shovels scraped up the balance and dumped it into the truck. This floor was filthy. Yet they set Antanas with his mop slopping the pickle into a hole that connected with a sink, where it was caught and used over again forever. And if that were not enough, there was a trap in the pipe, where all the scraps of meat and odds and ends of refuse were caught, and every few days it was the old man's task to clean these out, and shovel their contents into one of the trucks with the rest of the meat. This was the experience of Antanas. And then there came also Jonas and Maria with tales to tell. Maria was working for one of the independent packers, and was quite beside herself and outrageous with triumph over the sums of money she was making as a painter of cans. But one day she walked home with a pale-faced little woman who worked opposite her, Jadwiga Marcinkus by name, and Jadwiga told her how she, Maria, had chanced to get her job. She had taken the place of an Irish woman who had been working in that factory ever since anyone could remember, for over 15 years, so she declared. Mary Dennis was her name, and a long time ago she had been seduced and had a little boy. He was a cripple and an epileptic. But still, he was all that she had in the world to love, and they lived in a little room alone somewhere back of Halstead Street, where the Irish were. Mary had had consumption, and all day long you might hear her coughing as she worked. Of late she had been going all to pieces, and when Maria came, the forelady had suddenly decided to turn her off. The forelady had to come up to a certain standard herself, and could not stop for sick people, Jadwiga explained. The fact that Mary had been there so long had not made any difference to her. It was doubtful if she even knew that, for both the forelady and the superintendent were new people, having only been there 2 or 3 years themselves. Jadwiga did not know what had become of the poor creature. She would have gone to see her, but had been sick herself. She had pains in her back all the time, Jadwiga explained, and feared that she had womb trouble. It was not fit work for a woman, handling 14-pound cans all day. It was a striking circumstance that Jonas, too, had gotten his job by the misfortune of some other person. Jonas pushed a truck loaded with hams from the smoke room onto an elevator, and thence to the packing rooms. The trucks were all of iron and heavy, and they put about 60 hams on each of them, a load of more than 1/4 ton. On the uneven floor, it was a task for a man to start one of these trucks, unless he was a giant, and when it was once started, he naturally tried his best to keep it going. There was always the boss prowling about, and if there was a second's delay, he would fall to cursing. Lithuanians and Slovaks and such, who could not understand what was said to them, the bosses were wont to kick about the place like so many dogs. Therefore, these trucks went for the most part on the run, and the predecessor of Jonas had been jammed against the wall by one and crushed in a horrible and nameless manner. All of these were sinister incidents, but they were trifles compared to what Jorgis saw with his own eyes before long. One curious thing he had noticed the very first day, in his profession as shoveler of guts, which was the sharp trick of the floor bosses whenever there chanced to come a slunk calf. Any man who knows anything about butchering knows that the flesh of a cow that is about to calve, or has just calved, is not fit for food. A good many of these came every day to the packing houses. And of course, if they had chosen, it would have been an easy matter for the packers to keep them till they were fit for food. But for the saving of time and fodder, it was the law that cows of that sort came along with the others, and whoever noticed it would tell the boss, and the boss would start up a conversation with the government inspector, and the two would stroll away. So in a trice, the carcass of the cow would be cleaned out, and the entrails would have vanished. It was Jorgis's task to slide them into the trap, calves and all. And on the floor below, they took out these slunk calves, and butchered them for meat, and used even the skins of them. One day a man slipped and hurt his leg, and that afternoon, when the last of the cattle had been disposed of, and the men were leaving, Jorgis was ordered to remain and do some special work which this injured man had usually done. It was late, almost dark, and the government inspectors had all gone, and there were only 12 men on the floor. That day they had killed about 4,000 cattle, and these cattle had come in freight trains from far states, and some of them had got hurt. There were some with broken legs and some with gored sides. There were some that had died, from what cause, no one could say. And they were all to be disposed of, here in darkness and silence. Downers, the men called them, and the packing house had a special elevator upon which they were raised to the killing beds, where the gang proceeded to handle them with an air of businesslike nonchalance, which said, plainer than any words, that it was a matter of everyday routine. It took a couple of hours to get them out of the way, and in the end, Jorgis saw them go into the chilling rooms with the rest of the meat, being carefully scattered here and there, so that they could not be identified. When he came home that night, he was in a very somber mood, having begun to see at last how those might be right who had laughed at him for his faith in America. Chapter 6. Jorgis and Ona were very much in love. They had waited a long time. It was now well into the second year, and Jorgis judged everything by the criterion of its helping or hindering their union. All his thoughts were there. He accepted the family because it was a part of Ona, and he was interested in the house because it was to be Ona's home. Even the tricks and cruelties he saw at Durham's had little meaning for him just then, save as they might happen to affect his future with Ona. The marriage would have been at once if they had had their way, but this would mean that they would have to do without any wedding feast, and when they suggested this, they came into conflict with the old people. To Teta Elzbieta especially, the very suggestion was an affliction. What? She would cry. To be married on the roadside like a parcel of beggars? No, no. Elzbieta had some traditions behind her. She had been a person of importance in her girlhood, had lived on a big estate and had servants, and might have married well and been a lady, but for the fact that there had been 9 daughters and no sons in the family. Even so, however, she knew what was decent, and clung to her traditions with desperation. They were not going to lose all caste, even if they had come to be unskilled laborers in Packingtown, and that Ona had even talked of omitting a Vasilia was enough to keep her stepmother lying awake all night. It was in vain for them to say that they had so few friends. They were bound to have friends in time, and then the friends would talk about it. They must not give up what was right for a little money. If they did, the money would never do them any good. They could depend upon that. And Elzbieta would call upon Dede Antanas to support her. There was a fear in the souls of these two lest this journey to a new country might somehow undermine the old home virtues of their children. The very first Sunday, they had all been taken to Mass, and poor as they were, Elzbieta had felt it advisable to invest a little of her resources in a representation of the Babe of Bethlehem, made in plaster and painted in brilliant colors. Though it was only a foot high, there was a shrine with 4 snow-white steeples and the Virgin standing with her child in her arms, and the kings and shepherds and wise men bowing down before him. It had cost 50 cents, but Elzbieta had a feeling that money spent for such things was not to be counted too closely. It would come back in hidden ways. The piece was beautiful on the parlor mantel, and one could not have a home without some sort of ornament. The cost of the wedding feast would, of course, be returned to them, but the problem was to raise it even temporarily. They had been in the neighborhood so short a time that they could not get much credit, and there was no one except Shedvilas from whom they could borrow even a little. Evening after evening, Jorgis and Ona would sit and figure the expenses, calculating the term of their separation. They could not possibly manage it decently for less than $200, and even though they were welcome to count in the whole of the earnings of Maria and Jonas as a loan, they could not hope to raise this sum in less than 4 or 5 months. So Ona began thinking of seeking employment herself, saying that if she had even ordinarily good luck, she might be able to take 2 months off the time. They were just beginning to adjust themselves to this necessity when out of the clear sky there fell a thunderbolt upon them, a calamity that scattered all their hopes to the four winds. About a block away from them, there lived another Lithuanian family, consisting of an elderly widow and 1 grown son. Their name was Majauskas, and our friends struck up an acquaintance with them before long. One evening they came over for a visit, and naturally the first subject upon which their conversation turned was the neighborhood and its history. And then Grandmother Majauskiene, as the old lady was called, proceeded to recite to them a string of horrors that fairly froze their blood. She was a wrinkled-up and wizened personage. She must have been 80. And as she mumbled the grim story through her toothless gums, she seemed a very old witch to them. Grandmother Majauskiene had lived in the midst of misfortune so long that it had come to be her element, and she talked about starvation, sickness, and death, as other people might about weddings and holidays. The thing came gradually. In the first place, as to the house they had bought, it was not new at all, as they had supposed. It was about 15 years old, and there was nothing new upon it but the paint, which was so bad that it needed to be put on new every year or two. The house was one of a whole row that was built by a company which existed to make money by swindling poor people. The family had paid $1,500 for it, and it had not cost the builders 500 when it was new. Grandmother Mayushkiene knew that, because her son belonged to a political organization with a contractor who put up exactly such houses. They used the very flimsiest and cheapest material. They built the houses a dozen at a time, and they cared about nothing at all except the outside shine. The family could take her word as to the trouble they would have, for she had been through it all. She and her son had bought their house in exactly the same way. They had fooled the company, however, for her son was a skilled man, who made as high as $100 a month. And, as he had had sense enough not to marry, they had been able to pay for the house. Grandmother Mayushkiene saw that her friends were puzzled at this remark. They did not quite see how paying for the house was fooling the company. Evidently, they were very inexperienced. Cheap as the houses were, they were sold with the idea that the people who bought them would not be able to pay for them. When they failed, if it were only by a single month, they would lose the house and all that they had paid on it, and then the company would sell it over again. And did they often get a chance to do that? Dieve. Grandmother Mayushkiene raised her hands. They did it, how often no one could say, but certainly more than half of the time. They might ask anyone who knew anything at all about Packingtown as to that. She had been living here ever since this house was built, and she could tell them all about it. And had it ever been sold before? Susimilki. Why, since it had been built, no less than 4 families that their informant could name had tried to buy it and failed. She would tell them a little about it. The first family had been Germans. The families had all been of different nationalities. There had been a representative of several races that had displaced each other in the stockyards. Grandmother Mayushkiene had come to America with her son at a time when, so far as she knew, there was only one other Lithuanian family in the district. The workers had all been Germans then, skilled cattle butchers that the packers had brought from abroad to start the business. Afterward, as cheaper labor had come, these Germans had moved away. The next were the Irish. There had been 6 or 8 years when Packingtown had been a regular Irish city. There were a few colonies of them still here, enough to run all the unions and the police force and get all the graft. But the most of those who were working in the packing houses had gone away at the next drop in wages, after the big strike. The Bohemians had come then, and after them the Poles. People said that old man Durham himself was responsible for these immigrations. He had sworn that he would fix the people of Packingtown so that they would never again call a strike on him. And so he had sent his agents into every city and village in Europe to spread the tale of the chances of work and high wages at the stockyards. The people had come in hordes, and old Durham had squeezed them tighter and tighter, speeding them up and grinding them to pieces, and sending for new ones. The Poles, who had come by tens of thousands, had been driven to the wall by the Lithuanians, and now the Lithuanians were giving way to the Slovaks. Who there was poorer and more miserable than the Slovaks? Grandmother Mayushkiene had no idea, but the packers would find them, never fear. It was easy to bring them, for wages were really much higher, and it was only when it was too late that the poor people found out that everything else was higher, too. They were like rats in a trap. That was the truth. And more of them were piling in every day. By and by, they would have their revenge, though, for the thing was getting beyond human endurance, and the people would rise and murder the packers. Grandmother Mayushkiene was a socialist, or some such strange thing. Another son of hers was working in the mines of Siberia, and the old lady herself had made speeches in her time, which made her seem all the more terrible to her present auditors. They called her back to the story of the house. The German family had been a good sort. To be sure, they had been a great many of them, which was a common failing in Packingtown. But they had worked hard, and the father had been a steady man. And they had a good deal more than half paid for the house, but he had been killed in an elevator accident in Durham's. Then there had come the Irish, and there had been lots of them, too. The husband drank and beat the children. The neighbors could hear them shrieking any night. They were behind with their rent all the time, but the company was good to them. There was some politics back of that. Grandmother Mayushkiene could not say just what, but the Laffertys had belonged to the War Whoop League, which was a sort of political club of all the thugs and rowdies in the district, and if you belonged to that, you could never be arrested for anything. Once upon a time, old Lafferty had been caught with a gang that had stolen cows from several of the poor people of the neighborhood and butchered them in an old shanty back of the yards and sold them. He had been in jail only 3 days for it, and had come out laughing, and had not even lost his place in the packing house. He had gone all to ruin with the drink, however, and lost his power. One of his sons, who was a good man, had kept him and the family up for a year or two, but then he had got sick with consumption. And that was another thing, Grandmother Myushkiene interrupted herself. This house was unlucky. Every family that lived in it, someone was sure to get consumption. Nobody could tell why that was. There must be something about a house, or the way it was built. Some folks said it was because the building had begun in the dark of the moon. There were dozens of houses that way in Packingtown. Sometimes there would be a particular room that you could point out. If anybody slept in that room, he was just as good as dead. With this house, it had been the Irish first, and then a Bohemian family had lost a child in it, though to be sure, that was uncertain, since it was hard to tell what was the matter with children who worked in the yards. In those days, there had been no law about the age of children. The packers had worked all but the babies. At this remark, the family looked puzzled, and Grandmother Myushkiene again had to make an explanation. That it was against the law for children to work before they were 16. What was the sense of that, they asked. They had been thinking of letting little Stanislovas go to work. Well, there was no need to worry, Grandmother Myushkiene said. The law made no difference, except that it forced people to lie about the ages of their children. One would like to know what the lawmakers expected them to do. There were families that had no possible means of support except the children, and the law provided them no other way of getting a living. Very often a man could get no work in Packingtown for months, while a child could go and get a place easily. There was always some new machine by which the packers could get as much work out of a child as they had been able to get out of a man, and for a third of the pay. To come back to the house again, it was the woman of the next family that had died. That was after they had been there nearly 4 years, and this woman had had twins regularly every year. And there had been more than you could count when they moved in. After she died, the man would go to work all day and leave them to shift for themselves. The neighbors would help them now and then, for they would almost freeze to death. At the end, there were 3 days that they were alone before it was found out that the father was dead. He was a floorsman at Jones's, and a wounded steer had broken loose and smashed him against the pillar. Then the children had been taken away, and the company had sold the house that very same week to a party of emigrants. So this grim old woman went on with her tale of horrors. How much of it was exaggeration, who could tell? It was only too plausible. There was that about consumption, for instance. They knew nothing about consumption, whatever, except that it made people cough, and for 2 weeks they had been worrying about a coughing spell of Antanas. It seemed to shake him all over, and it never stopped. You could see a red stain wherever he had spit upon the floor. And yet all these things were as nothing to what came a little later. They had begun to question the old lady as to why one family had been unable to pay, trying to show her by figures that it ought to have been possible, and Grandmother Myushkiene had disputed their figures. You say $12 a month, but that does not include the interest. Then they stared at her. Interest, they cried. Interest on the money you still owe, she answered. But we don't have to pay any interest, they exclaimed, three or four at once. We only have to pay $12 each month. And for this, she laughed at them. You are like all the rest, she said. They trick you and eat you alive. They never sell the houses without interest. Get your deed and see. Then, with a horrible sinking of the heart, Teta Elzbieta unlocked her bureau and brought out the paper that had already caused them so many agonies. Now they sat around, scarcely breathing, while the old lady, who could read English, ran over it. Yes, she said, finally. Here it is, of course, with interest thereon monthly at the rate of 7% per annum. And there followed a dead silence. What does that mean? Asked Jorgis finally, almost in a whisper. That means, replied the other, that you have to pay them $8.40 next month, as well as the $12. Then again, there was not a sound. It was sickening, like a nightmare, in which suddenly something gives way beneath you, and you feel yourself sinking, sinking down into bottomless abysses. As if in a flash of lightning they saw themselves, victims of a relentless fate, cornered, trapped in the grip of destruction. All the fair structure of their hopes came crashing about their ears, and all the time the old woman was going on, talking. They wished that she would be still. Her voice sounded like the croaking of some dismal raven. Jorgis sat with his hands clenched and beads of perspiration on his forehead, and there was a great lump in Ona's throat, choking her. Then suddenly, Teta Elzbieta broke the silence with a wail, and Maria began to wring her hands and sob.
I bade the man.
All their outcry did them no good, of course. There sat Grandmother Mayuskine, unrelenting, typifying fate. No, of course it was not fair. But then fairness had nothing to do with it. And of course they had not known it. They had not been intended to know it. But it was in the deed, and that was all that was necessary, as they would find when the time came. Somehow or other they got rid of their guest, and then they passed a night of lamentation. The children woke up and found out that something was wrong, and they wailed and would not be comforted. In the morning, of course, most of them had to go to work. The packing houses would not stop for their sorrows. But by 7 o'clock, Ona and her stepmother were standing at the door of the office of the agent. Yes, he told them when he came, it was quite true that they would have to pay interest. And then Teta Elzbieta broke forth into protestations and reproaches so that the people outside stopped and peered in at the window. The agent was as bland as ever. He was deeply pained, he said. He had not told them simply because he had supposed they would understand that they had to pay interest upon their debt as a matter of course. So they came away, and Ona went down to the yards, and at noontime saw Jorgis and told him. Jorgis took it stolidly. He had made up his mind to it by this time. It was part of fate. They would manage it somehow. He made his usual answer. I will work harder. It would upset their plans for a time, and it would perhaps be necessary for Ona to get work after all. Then Ona added that Teta Elzbieta had decided that little Stanislovas would have to work too. It was not fair to let Jorgis and her support the family. The family would have to help as it could. Previously, Jorgis had scouted this idea, but now knit his brows and nodded his head slowly. Yes, perhaps it would be best. They would all have to make some sacrifices now. So Ona set out that day to hunt for work, and at night Maria came home, saying that she had met a girl named Yasai Tite, who had a friend that worked in one of the wrapping rooms in Brown's, and might get a place for Ona there. Only the forelady was the kind that takes presents. It was no use for anyone to ask her for a place unless at the same time they slipped a $10 bill into her hand. Jorgis was not in the least surprised at this now. He merely asked what the wages of the place would be. So negotiations were opened, and after an interview, Ona came home and reported that the forelady seemed to like her and had said that, while she was not sure, she thought she might be able to put her at work sewing covers on hams, a job at which she could earn as much as $8 or $10 a week. That was a bid, so Maria reported after consulting her friend, and then there was an anxious conference at home. The work was done in one of the cellars, and Jorgis did not want Ona to work in such a place. But then, it was easy work, and one could not have everything. So in the end, Ona, with a $10 bill burning a hole in her palm, had another interview with the forelady. Meantime, Teta Elzbieta had taken Stanislovas to the priest and gotten a certificate to the effect that he was 2 years older than he was, and with it the little boy now sallied forth to make his fortune in the world. It chanced that Durham had just put in a wonderful new lard machine, and when the special policeman in front of the time station saw Stanislovas and his document, he smiled to himself and told him to go. Cha, cha, pointing. And so Stanislovas went down a long stone corridor and up a flight of stairs, which took him into a room lighted by electricity, with the new machines for filling lard cans at work in it. The lard was finished on the floor above, and it came in little jets like beautiful, wriggling, snow-white snakes of unpleasant odor. There were several kinds and sizes of jets, and after a certain precise quantity had come out, each stopped automatically, and their wonderful machine made a turn and took the can under another jet, and so on, until it was filled neatly to the brim and pressed tightly and smoothed off. To attend to all this and fill several hundred cans of lard per hour, there were necessary two human creatures, one of whom knew how to place an empty lard can on a certain spot every few seconds, and the other of whom knew how to take a full lard can off a certain spot every few seconds and set it upon a tray. And so, after little Stanislavas had stood gazing timidly about him for a few minutes, a man approached him and asked what he wanted, to which Stanislavas said, "Job." Then the man said, "How old?" And Stanislavas answered, 16. Once or twice every year, a state inspector would come wandering through the packing plants, asking a child here and there how old he was. And so the packers were very careful to comply with the law, which cost them as much trouble as was now involved in the bosses taking the document from the little boy and glancing at it, and then sending it to the office to be filed away. Then he set someone else at a different job and showed the lad how to place a lard can every time the empty arm of the remorseless machine came to him. And so was decided the place in the universe of little Stanislavas, and his destiny till the end of his days. Hour after hour, day after day, year after year, it was fated that he should stand upon a certain square foot of floor from 7 in the morning until noon, and again from 12:30 till 5:30, making never a motion and thinking never a thought, save for the setting of lard cans. In summer, the stench of the warm lard would be nauseating, and in winter, the cans would all but freeze to his naked little fingers in the unheated cellar. Half the year, it would be dark as night when he went into work, and dark as night again when he came out. And so he would never know what the sun looked like on weekdays. And for this, at the end of the week, he would carry home $3 to his family, being his pay at the rate of 5 cents per hour. Just about his proper share of the total earnings of the 1,000,000 3/4 of children who are now engaged in earning their livings in the United States. And meantime, because they were young, and hope is not to be stifled before its time, Jurgis and Ona were again calculating, for they had discovered that the wages of Stanislavas would a little more than pay the interest, which left them just about as they had been before. It would be but fair to them to say that the little boy was delighted with his work and at the idea of earning a lot of money, and also that the two were very much in love with each other. Chapter 7. All summer long the family toiled, and in the fall they had money enough for Jurgis and Ona to be married, according to home traditions of decency. In the latter part of November they hired a hall and invited all of their new acquaintances, who came and left them over $100 in debt. It was a bitter and cruel experience, and it plunged them into an agony of despair. Such a time of all times for them to have it, when their hearts were made tender. Such a pitiful beginning it was for their married life. They loved each other so, and they could not have the briefest respite. It was a time when everything cried out to them that they ought to be happy, when wonder burned in their hearts and leaped into flame at the slightest breath. They were shaken to the depths of them with the awe of love they realized. And was it so very weak of them that they cried for a little peace? They had opened their hearts like flowers to the springtime, and the merciless winter had fallen upon them. They wondered if ever any love that had blossomed in the world had been so crushed and trampled. Over them, relentless and savage, there cracked the lash of want. The morning after the wedding, it sought them as they slept and drove them out before daybreak to work. Ona was scarcely able to stand with exhaustion, but if she were to lose her place, they would be ruined, and she would surely lose it if she were not on time that day. They all had to go, even little Stanislavas, who was ill from overindulgence in sausages and sarsaparilla. All that day he stood at his lard machine, rocking unsteadily, his eyes closing in spite of him, and he all but lost his place, even so, for the foreman booted him twice to waken him. It was fully a week before they were all normal again, and meantime, with whining children and cross adults, the house was not